Welcome to the ADAA podcast about the art of persuasion, changing the mind on OCD. And today we're talking with Dr. Reed Wilson of the Anxiety Disorders Treatment Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Dr. Wilson, let me ask you, what is a therapist's primary objective in treating a patient with OCD?
Well, we can at least say what the primary objective is to start in the treatment. And the most essential thing to manage with people with OCD is the idea that the content is irrelevant. Same concept we would have for people with generalized anxiety disorder. These are worry-making machines with generalized anxiety. Very similar with obsessive-compulsive disorder. People are terrified at the level of content. Content meaning that I will poison my children, that I'm touched salmonella, that I might have run someone over, that I have forgotten to turn off the water and the house is going to flood. You cannot possibly help anyone with OCD if we operate at the level of content. And this is where I tend to disagree with some of my colleagues, particularly in my specialty, which is cognitive therapy, where we talk about evidence and argue with people around the validity of some of their thoughts around the content. And again, if we think about this as a competition and a game between OCD and the client, there's no possible way at the level of content that the person can ever win. So we want to first elevate it up one level, chunk it up in abstraction, that the core two pieces that I want to pay attention to is seeking out uncertainty and seeking out distress. And yes, my content, leaving the stove on for 5 minutes and then coming back and turning it off and then leaving the room and not checking it, the content's going to create uncertainty. The distinction that we have to make again and again with people is we're going to use your content to generate that generic state of uncertainty. When you have the uncertainty, what do you want to do with it? Keep it as long as you can. That's the goal, because OCD only lives in people who cannot tolerate uncertainty, cannot tolerate the distress that comes with it. So if you want to be like Velcro, be seeking out certainty. A lot of people that we work with OCD have reassurance rituals, so they'll have a spouse checking behind them to make sure their windows are locked, or go seek out help from the doctor to reassure them that they don't have Lou Gehrig's disease, or and that lasts about 3 weeks or 2 days, and then they have to do it again. So those kinds of reassurances don't help either. I need to be able to tolerate uncertainty, not know the answer. So when the obsession pops up, I want to notice it and go, okay, great. Now I have no idea what's going to happen next after I've washed my hands for the 30 seconds I've agreed to wash it and left the kitchen. And that's my goal, is to be able to tolerate that. So that's the very first step that we want to go. If we don't get there, we're not going to get anywhere. And really, this is where we get trapped with people. People will get one-third better, a half better, meaning a lot of their rituals will drop away and they've got more freedom. And what that typically means with these people is the lesser problems are gone, and now we're left with the big toughies because they're still focused on content.
So I was going to ask you what, as a therapist, common obstacles that you might encounter with a client. Is this one of them that they get partially better?
Sure, and it's not always easy to tell that they're holding out this secret of, because they'll go through the motion sometimes of practices with you, but not really want to expose themselves to all the threats that they had. I had a physician I was working with who was afraid of contamination, was using ammoniated Windex, spraying himself all over his body and so forth. And his wife actually was having damage done to her larynx because of the ammonia. But still, this physician, because it gives a sign of how powerful OCD is, could not stop that process. Well, in treatment, we immediately switched to vinegar-based Windex. Didn't seem to bother him at all, and then started watering it down, got it down to about one-third Windex and two-thirds water, but we just plateaued off of there because he absolutely believed at some level that there was contamination, and this diluted bottle was working with You know, so I would do practices with him where I'd have him, you know, spray all over his body, which he does twice. Spray one time all over his body, wait 5 minutes, and then do it a second time with hopes that he'd get a little break in there. But totally intolerable to even wait that 5 minutes. So people get pretty darn stuck, and that's probably how tough it is. That's probably the toughest part with people. I do a lot of work with people in a two-day intensive, and the second trouble that we have is follow-up around that. You can teach people a lot of good things, and they can start to get better. But if they don't buy into the protocol and continue to practice consistently, frequently, without repetition, developing that habituation, then they tend to slide backwards more easily.
So why do they resist or not buy in? Are there any typical answers?
They're terrified. You know, I had somebody trying to do a TV show on working, you know, doing some reality show, working with people with OCD, and they kept asking me over and over again, well, tell us some of the really threatening exposures that you do with these people. And I was trying to convey to them, every exposure we do is terrifying for people. Have I, you know, I'm going to feel a bump in the road and then keep driving instead of going back and checking, well, in this person's mind, I possibly just bumped somebody into the ditch. They're lying there in the high grass. They will be dead by morning. No one knows they're there. They'll bleed to death. I have to find them or it'll be on me. So, all of those, you know, vents. I'm going to forget to put the top down in the toilet seat when I go to bed, and my child will get up in the middle of the night, fall in, and drown. So the terror is really what works against us primarily, and so that's why we want to work on this concept of content is irrelevant, and I want to go towards uncertainty, but the uncertainty has nothing to do with down here at ground level. It has to do with just a state of being.
So in your experience, the most successful strategies for treatment, for getting people beyond the plateau, certainly, are there any you can discuss?
Sure. First is understand that the content's irrelevant. That's essential. The second thing, which is, again, one that is hard for some people to swallow, is when the obsession pops up, oh my gosh, I might have poisoned my parents by touching their toothbrush with a poison and I can't remember. When the obsession pops up, accept it. Well, of course, that's absolutely opposite of what they want to do. Why? I've just had a thought of strangling my child. You want me to accept that thought? Yes, because the thought is meaningless and purposeless. It has no rational validity, and therefore, why mess with it? And second, anything that's resisted will persist. So we want to understand the content's irrelevant. Second, when the obsession pops up, go, okay, well, that's fine. I just had that obsession. Well, I have OCD. This is what we do. We generate thoughts that make us anxious, and so that's fine. And that's opposite, obviously opposite of logic, but also opposite of what the OCD requires to maintain itself. And then the last two things that I focus on is seek out uncertainty and seek out distress, because that's going to be your ticket through suffering. If I do not approach uncertainty, there is no earthly way I will get better. And one of the things that, you know, we use medications with people, a lot of the antidepressants. Well, what do the antidepressants offer us? One of the main functions of an antidepressant is that it makes those obsessions less intense. And so if we're using medications with the work that we're doing, it's going to lower the intensity of the thoughts. Not going to stop the thoughts from happening, but it gives them a little more power to begin to practice those skills and then discover they have some control. And then when they're ready, if they want to, they can taper off those medications. You know, part of what happens when they taper off medications is the brain says, this is a new context, I haven't felt this before, and a lot of times those obsessions will come back, and you just use the very same skill. So I know you didn't ask me about medications, but there's probably 2/3 of the people I see are already on medications when they walk in the door, so it's something to be working with. So,
is there a relapse issue as well, aside from medications, that you get somebody to a comfortable point for them in their lives, and years go by, and then a new context, so to speak, comes up, and they have to start all over?
Sure. There's a few thoughts here. One is the relapse rate is much less with cognitive behavioral therapy than medications, but it's certainly conceivable. Anxiety disorders run the life cycle, and so you can be an excellent student of the work and be healthy and have no symptoms, and 3 years later, boom, it hits again, just like panic disorder can and some of the other disorders. So one is you don't want to be ashamed at that occurring. You can expect that that might occur. You know, one of the ways I have people look at it pragmatically is not so much, well, this is, you know, anxiety disorders like type 1 diabetes. You're just going to have to suffer through it all your life and just learn to handle it. Not that way. But the attitude or the stance to have is, look, if this goes on the rest of my life, fine. What I have is a protocol for responding to it. And the reason to take on that stance is that's the best stance to have it slough off more often. If I go, I hope these skills work because I have to get rid of this, and then now we're working against ourselves. But it does run the life cycle. I think it's helpful for people to know that when there's changes, like decelerating from medication or stressors that come up, very often they could come back. Sometimes these disorders transform. I had a woman I worked with very successfully with OCD. 12 years later, she comes back in with bulimia, which is an OC spectrum disorder. So, again, it can take different shapes. Unfortunately for this woman, she then hid the bulimia for 4 years before it was finally discovered by her husband and she got some help. So there's the other problem, and you start feeling ashamed, or you, in her case, the perception, I can't possibly get over this particular disorder, so I don't want to admit it to anyone. It's very much what we get with people with drug abuse or alcohol dependence. I don't want to tell anyone, because the first thing you do when you say, I've got problems with alcohol, is your friends and family say, well, you need to stop drinking. Well, the person is terrified because they have no idea they have the capacity to do that. So to acknowledge it if it links immediately over here to changing. So the other thing that we need to be doing as a society over time is to reduce some of the stigma and the demands for change that come for these people so that they can come back in and get the work done again.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson, for the most illuminating discussion about OCD. And this is Jean Kaplan-Tycho for ADAA.